Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I pretty much on every major award show in the last 15 years, and it's been really a fun journey and really a great way to get products into the hands of celebrities and to have those clients benefit from that association. We do have Mace Brands providing pepper spray guns, pink for the girls and camo for the guys, so if the paparazzi gets too far out of control, they can actually just mace them, which is kind of a fun, intense way of dealing with the paparazzi, I suppose.
That's the owner of a company called Distinctive Assets there, which puts together lavish gift bags for Oscar nominees each year. We'll hear what's in this year's swag bag and why the Academy is suing Distinctive Assets. But first, Governor Jerry Brown introduced a $177 million plan yesterday to test and clean up the areas contaminated by the old Exide battery recycling plant. It comes almost a year since Exide Technologies shuttered its Vernon facility to avoid criminal charges for illegally handling toxic materials. Now, for decades, the plant operated without a formal permit, melting down used car batteries. Exide polluted the air and the soil underneath the plant and in surrounding neighborhoods as well with lead and other toxic materials, yet testing and cleanup efforts have been very, very slow. And thousands of angry and fearful residents have been waiting for their homes to be tested or for their yards with confirmed high levels of contamination to be cleaned up. In a moment, we're going to talk with one such resident whose yard contains very high levels of lead contamination. But first, let's hear more about Governor Brown's announcement. Nancy Martinez is a staff writer for Eastern Group Publication, which covers East LA's communities, and she's been following this story for some time. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Now, this effort needed to clean up the mess that Exide made is a pretty massive effort. What are we talking about here, and how much of a boost will the governor's plan be?
Well, we're looking at over, you know, up to 10,000 homes that may be impacted by contamination. And this is in an area that is 1.7 miles away from the Vernon facility. So people have estimated that this could be in the hundreds of millions. So having $176 million from the governor is a big boost to funding for cleanup and testing.
Because the governor, originally, there was only just a few million dollars for this cleanup, right?
Right. In the original agreement with the U.S. attorney, they put aside $50 million, and a big chunk of that was for the plant closure itself. I believe only $9 million was for the homes. So this is a big milestone for the cleanup that we're seeing in it, for Exide cleanup.
Where's this money going to come from, Nancy?
So it's actually coming in the form of a loan, and it's so that Exide will pay back the cleanup that will begin.
So the state is fronting the money, and then the state is going to go after Exide to give the money back?
Right, and they're hoping to do that with some kind of fingerprint technology. Any contamination that they find was caused by Exide must be paid by Exide, and that's under their agreement with the U.S. attorney.
What kind of a process is that? How do you delineate what lead contamination happened from Exide and what happened from I don't know, naturally occurring lead or some other industrial manufacturing plant?
Well, along with lead, there are other toxins that might identify Exide as the culprit. And so they will be doing that in some isotope testing that will act as a fingerprint to point to Exide as the cause.
To show that it was Exide that caused this and not anything else.
Right.
I want to talk about, because this is a big problem, and we've heard about it for a little while, how many people may have been exposed to these toxic materials? We're not just talking about lead. We're also talking about arsenic as well, as a direct result of the practices at Exide.
Well, initially, the South Coast Air Quality Management District announced that about over 100,000 people in the southeast and east side communities were exposed to arsenic and lead over the years. And that was when Exide was still operating. So that's just the initial assessment. With up to 10,000 homes being impacted by this contamination, people believe it could be millions of people.
Millions of people.
Right, and that's just in the 1.7-mile radius. Now people are saying that line could be extended even further, so we really don't know the extent of the damage right now until we get more of the testing completed.
Yeah, you have to do the testing, and we're not talking about just homes. We're also talking about schools and parks in that area and daycare centers and all sorts of places.
Right, there are parks in the area and schools. So we're talking about a place where pregnant women, children gather frequently.
I want to introduce Terry Gonzalez Cano, who is a resident of Boyle Heights, one of the neighborhoods that's affected near the Exide plant. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
How close is your home to the now closed plant?
I'm close to a mile away from the Exide plant.
A mile away. Did you grow up in the area? How long have you lived there?
I have lived here all my life. My family has been here for four generations in Boyle Heights on the same property.
Wow. Okay, so a mile away, and you have at your home levels of lead, and I want to throw out some numbers, and it can be confusing here, so I'm gonna do it kind of slowly. 1,550 parts per million. That is way beyond acceptable levels, right?
Correct.
How high is that? What's an acceptable level?
Well, what was explained to us by the state before my soil was tested was anything over 80 parts per million was something that they needed to be concerned about and look at.
80 parts per million. You have 1,550.
Correct.
Parts per million.
Yeah.
The Department of Toxic Substances, as you mentioned, is supposed to be cleaning up residents with levels even lower than that. 1,000, I think, parts per million, or maybe even lower than that. I think they're still working all the details. You have a son, Terry, who lives with you in your home in Boyle Heights. Have you had to place any restrictions on him, like playing outside? If the soil is contaminated, you don't want him out there?
Oh, definitely. He's not allowed to play in the dirt. If he goes outside, he has to stay only on the concrete, and he has to immediately wash his hands and his face, you know, several times a day. Basically, anytime he comes in from outside.
This is a very industrialized area, Terry. You said you grew up, you're fourth generation there. Did you ever worry about all the industry that was around you, the manufacturing plants that are there?
No, we assumed that the state agencies that were in place to monitor and protect us from situations like this, we assumed they were doing their job.
Nancy Martinez, who's the staff writer for Eastern Group Publications, I want to talk to you about the high lead levels. Do we have a baseline, like where they're going to start cleaning up neighborhoods and when they're going to start doing it?
Right. So homes with 1,000 ppm are the high priority homes that need to be cleaned immediately. And that's also homes where pregnant women or children, that they're given the highest priority. Priority one is what they're called. And that is based on the soil sampling.
Terry, do you know, I mean, has anyone come to you and said, hey, we're going to clean this up starting at this point, now, soon, weeks?
No. I mean, we've heard for when I got my results back in April of 2015, they told me then that, you know, all priority one, which is 1,000 and above, would be cleaned first, but there was no date set as to when that was going to happen.
What does it mean to hear you're one step closer to having your home and your neighborhood cleaned up, Terry, when someone says it's going to be cleaned up? How does that resonate with you?
Now it basically goes in one ear and out the other because, you know, for me, the definition of now is immediately. For, you know, the state in Exide, you know, now or first is I've been waiting, you know, since my soil was tested in September of 2014.
And you've had health issues. You and your family have had health issues in that area, right?
Oh, definitely.
Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, my parents had five children, and we basically all grew up in my parents' house and the house that I live in now, which used to belong to my grandmother. We went, we were raised on both properties, but my sisters who moved away and didn't spend as much time as we did here in these houses, they're relatively healthy, and everyone who stood back has multiple medical issues.
This has been, I know there have been several environmental stories that have come to the fore, I guess, in the past few weeks. Not only Flint, Michigan, with the lead poisoning in the water system there and the corroded pipes, but also with the SoCal gas utility leak, the natural gas leak going on in Porter Ranch. And I wonder how you feel as a resident. And having covered this story, too, for months and months now, that it's taken so long with so many complaints coming over the years, to be sure, in that area. How, as a resident, how do you feel about that? And have you been complaining for that period of time?
Oh, we've been complaining for years and begging for answers and action for years. And I have to say, when I saw the reaction to Porter Ranch and to Flint, I felt, bad for them because I know how they feel. But at the same time, because of that, I have never felt more worthless as I did at that moment, knowing that we spent years trying to get some action done, and I've lost my parents to the contamination, and we basically were still ignored up until very recently.
You've got other family members. You said you lost your parents, but you have other family members with terrible health problems as well.
Yes, I have. My brother has terminal cancer. There's nothing that they can do to save him, and my children are both have medical issues, including asthma, and basically everybody that lives here has their own inhaler and medical issues.
My sympathies to you, certainly, Terry. Nancy Martinez, we'll leave with this, and I want to know what the next steps will be once that money gets approved by the legislature, assuming it will be. What happens next?
Well, we're still looking at Exide's plant closure plan and DTSC's draft environmental impact report. And what that means is DTSC is still looking at how they are going to clean and decontaminate and remove the soil and the building at the Vernon facility. So that's still going on, and we're still waiting for public comment to be completed March 28th for that plan to move forward. And at that point, we'll see how long this closure will actually take. We're talking about years. People believe it's going to take decades.
And to be sure, the company is actually in bankruptcy, so I don't even know about the money going forward. A lot of questions, though, to be asked for sure.
Right. A lot of people worry about that. But according to this agreement, Exide is supposed to pay any amount that the government finds Exide is responsible for. So if they don't do that, they are still liable to criminal charges.
Nancy Martinez, who's a staff writer for Eastern Group Publication, which covers East L.A.'s communities. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And Terry Gonzalez-Cano, resident of Boyle Heights, fourth-generation resident there. And I want to thank you for sharing your story with us, and my sympathies, of course, for your family's health problems as well. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Do you live near the old Exide plant? What do you think of the new plan to clean up the area? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, a hospital in Los Feliz was under attack by computer hackers and paid a ransom of Bitcoin to free up its digital network. Digital hostage taking. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, sitting in for Madeline Brand. There's a heated debate that continues over whether Apple should unlock one of their phones to aid the feds in the San Bernardino attack investigation, that attack that took place last December. Shani Jardin is here to weigh in on the issue and other news of the digital world today. She's co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hi, Shani.
Hi, Steve.
So the argument goes that if the government thinks there is evidence of a crime in a locked cabinet, the owner would be compelled to unlock that cabinet to help in the investigation. Isn't this the same thing?
Well, yes and no. So we already have laws on the books that say if a technology device or let's say somebody's Gmail account might contain evidence that's really important for law enforcement in any sort of crime, not just terrorism, those involved have an obligation to help our government carry out justice. What's happening in this situation isn't that the court and the FBI are demanding that Apple unlock the phone. That would be one thing. What they're actually demanding is that Apple engineers design a whole new version of its iOS operating system that would basically be FBIOS, a version with all of the privacy and security features stripped. And that in and of itself, like, who could argue? Of course we want to know what happened in those mysterious 18 minutes that we don't know how to account for the killer's whereabouts. Of course we want to know if there's any data that could protect more American lives. But this is so much more far-reaching, and it's not clear that what is being sought would be unlocked with Apple agreeing to this government request.
Well, it's not agreeing, to be sure.
No.
And what it's saying, Apple, the computer giant, is saying, look, if we do have to develop this new iOS system to sort of get in through the back door, it will allow sort of hacking going forward. This will open up this giant can of worms.
Oh, man. Steve, so this is such an interesting story because we're talking about the largest tech company. We're talking about a case that is close to everyone's hearts. And we're talking about a device that so many of us carry around and entrust with our digital secrets every day, all day.
And it's not just iPhone. It could be an Android device. It could be any smartphone.
This is bigger. You know, the CEO of Google came out yesterday supporting Tim Cook's beautifully written letter, basically saying in so many words, no, we're not going to comply with this demand. But the way this is being framed right now is that this is a battle between security and privacy. It is a battle between surveillance and privacy. There are many, many things that could happen here. Let's say Apple does comply. This becomes a watershed moment. So the FBI and any other three-letter agencies or local law enforcement agencies could just pull you over when you're speeding down the freeway and say, oh, you know, while we're at it, we also want to take a look at what's on your Android
or your
iPhone.
Well, that's search and seizure, though, isn't it? There are laws against that.
And imagine then if criminals or a foreign government, let's imagine China wanting this same kind of access. Basically, once this magical thing is in the wild, everybody is going to want to find a way to replicate that.
It's a dangerous
Iran
precedent,
will do the
certainly.
Same thing.
A dangerous precedent.
It's a huge slippery slope.
A slippery slope. But there are some reports, Shani, that say Apple actually has done this in the past.
This is a gray area where certainly Apple and other tech companies have been pressured by law enforcement agencies to comply in ways that really exert a lot of control. But what's happening here really does set a precedent. The shooter obviously had a late enough version of the phone. This was recommended by the county that he actually turn on certain security features. Like, they acknowledged that this stuff was important. And what follows from this really would change our concept of privacy as we know it.
I want to talk about, well, privacy, number one, it's patients' privacy when they go to a hospital. And this hospital in Los Feliz that was hacked whomever, we don't even know who it was, but was held for ransom. Their network was attacked. They were held for ransom. I think it was $17,000 that they paid in Bitcoin to unlock its computers. This is an amazing story.
This is like a science fiction novel. I woke up this morning and learned that the ransom had been paid and was shocked. First, the $17,000 is a lot less than the criminals were asking for. So I guess you could say that the hospital got the data back at a bargain price. I'd really like to have been a fly on the wall when the hospital, the internet forensics guys, and the ransomware crooks were all negotiating with each other. But yeah, this is definitely already a crime. The idea of going to an institution, a hospital of all places, and holding access to patient data hostage for money.
It is a crime.
You know, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not a lawmaker. I did see today that there's a state senator, right, who's introducing a bill.
This is Bob Hertzberg, yeah. Ben Nyes.
Right, wanting to introduce a bill that would make ransomware specifically a crime. The definition being put forward is the idea
Well,
then
it's not a crime. Then this can happen?
No.
Is that going to help what Hertzberg is doing?
Maybe I'm a little too skeptical for my own good, but I think that this announcement was more about getting Mr. Hertzberg's name in the news.
And you know what? It's a hospital and we've got patient information. I mean, this could be a power plant. This could be a bank.
Exactly.
This could be our entire financial system.
Well, the hospital is bad enough. I've
been
in
them. That's awful.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But you know, what you're saying, like this again, you know, my opinion of this, I think it's a real mistake to have caved to that request, because I think the message that this sends to other cyber criminals is that this type of crime does indeed pay.
We don't know the specifics of the case, and we're not sure that there was this acquiescence that happened.
And they're paying in Bitcoin.
Have been part of a federal investigation. They may have gone through the whole motions.
We don't know everything yet.
Yeah, we don't know, and certainly we are watching it. I do want to talk about hacking quickly before we wrap this thing up, and this time a hack that happened that some people are applauding. This is a researcher in Russia who reportedly posted almost every single peer-reviewed academic journal ever published on her website. And the cost of access to those papers is obviously enormous. That is something that is getting a lot of praise these days.
It really
is. But should it get praise?
You know, it's so interesting, this setting all the scientific papers, the 47 million academic papers. She's like the Robin Hood of information. you know, one article might cost you $30. That's a lot of money. Nobody is mentioning the fact that this is what Aaron Swartz, the young hacker who killed himself after being hounded by federal prosecutors over a similar stunt. This is why that kid died. To me, it's amazing that here we are. We're talking about a story on the other side of the world where a code-literate young person is taking it upon themselves to set information free. I don't know if this is right or wrong, but good luck to publisher Elsevier, who's going after her, and any prosecutors who might want to pursue that case. I mean, going after intellectual property theft in Russia is a whole different ballgame than bullying a child prodigy hacker in Boston.
Well, in Boston, the company that owns the rights to this material is in the United States. She is in Russia. So is there some sort of weird extradition thing that you know, she can't be held responsible? Do we know?
I don't know the answer to that, Steve, but I can say there's a very famous American tech figure named Edward Snowden who chose Russia for a number of good reasons. One of them is that he's not going to be extradited back to the U.S. anytime soon.
I don't think there are any treaties in place between the two right now. Anyway.
Not that I'm aware of. Right. It's an interesting story. And another interesting thing about this Sci-Hub story, I bet if you ask somebody younger, you know, they have very different ideas about
this. It's a generational thing.
It's a very generational thing. She's a student, you know, and Aaron Swartz was a student, too. They have different ideas about this than the old white man running the publishing industry.
Interesting conversation. Shani Jardin from BoingBoing.net. A pleasure, always.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
So, should all research papers be available for free or available for next to nothing? Let us know, 844-PRESS-PLAY, or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, after Grey's Anatomy, Shonda Rhimes brought Scandal and How to Get Away with Murder to ABC.
What does it feel like to get to write the voice of a black woman? Somebody asked me that about Scandal, and I said, well, you know, McDreamy's been speaking in the voice of a black woman for a long time now, so it's been fine.
Will more women and people of color get their voices heard now that the networks hired their first African-American programming chief? That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, filling in for Madeline Brand.
The game. They say a person either has what it takes to play or they don't.
That, of course, was Seattle Grace Hospital's Dr. Meredith Gray expounding on the game of surgery. But the sentiment could also work as the inner monologue of, say, a new TV network president. Well, it turns out that Channing Dungey will have the chance to prove her mettle and her game over at ABC, home of shows like Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, and Black-ish. Dungey's just been named president of ABC Entertainment Group, becoming the first African-American to run one of the big four TV networks. And joining me now is Michael Schneider, chief content officer for TV Guide magazine, and he also co-hosts KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Steve.
Let's start with a backstory here, shall we? Why is this network shakeup happening right now?
Well, you know, it's interesting timing. We've been hearing rumblings for quite a while that ABC may be looking to shake things up. Part of the big change was a year ago, Ann Sweeney stepped down. She headed up Disney ABC Television Group for quite a while. She stepped down and was replaced by Ben Sherwood, who comes from ABC News. He took over. And since then, we've been hearing sort of some difference of opinion on the direction of the network between Ben and the chairman of ABC Entertainment, Paul Lee, and it all kind of came to a head yesterday.
What type of content do you think does Ben Sherwood want to see?
Well, he wants to see highly rated content, I suppose. One of the issues this year with ABC is that they are down in the ratings. Now, to be fair, everyone's pretty much down in the ratings these days. That's the new reality of broadcast television. But ABC had slumped to third place in the demographic 18 to 49 that advertisers care about the most, and some of its new shows weren't doing as well. Last year, ABC produced a number of new hits, including How to Get Away with Murder. Its success rate this year was a little bit lower, and so I think that's when the opening came to maybe make a change over there.
What shows had Paul Lee overseen?
Well, he had been there for almost 6 years, so he had overseen the development and airing of a number of big hits like Scandal, like Black-ish, Once Upon a Time, How to Get Away with Murder, like I mentioned. ABC had actually had a pretty strong streak for quite a while and really was doing a really good job with buzzy shows like the Shonda Rhimes shows that you mentioned on Thursday night, and also sort of bringing back the family comedy brand that ABC had been known for so long, the edgy family comedy brand, which had already been in place with Modern Family, and he added it to it with shows like The Goldbergs and Black-ish and Fresh Off the Boat, all really critically acclaimed shows that really sort of solidified ABC's brand in the comedy space.
You just reminded me that Grey's Anatomy, did you say it's on Thursday night?
Yeah.
I didn't even know it was still on, which is, I think it says more about me than anything
else.
Oh,
Steve, don't lie. I know you're a big fan.
I know you're tuning in. But Mike, this is the day and time where people are watching things on their phones and on iPads and tablets all over the place, computers. Is this an important position to even have?
Well, to be fair, the broadcast networks still command huge audiences, and they also command billions of dollars from advertisers every year. So the broadcast networks are still huge, but you're right in that the game is completely changing. Everyone's trying to figure out a new way to crack that nut, and it's all about owning really great intellectual property. They happen to own the Shonda Rhimes shows. So that's still a pretty big deal. For Channing Dungey, these jobs as entertainment presidents, they're not as big as they used to be. Once upon a time, these were jobs for showmen. They came out and they really commanded a lot of power. But as the networks consolidated and as they became sort of just one entity in these much larger conglomerates, that power sort of decreased. And you're right in that these big companies like Disney, like Comcast, the broadcast networks, they're nice. They're a portion of the overall landscape, but they don't sort of run the business like they once did.
Well, let's be honest. Yeah, we're not sitting in front of the console television, right? watching dramas on Wednesday night like we used to. I mean, we're watching television or content, I should say. We don't even call it TV anymore. It's content.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. You can find it anywhere, any place now. But there is still a good chunk of people who still watch TV live. Granted, on demand is growing, and of course, DVR usage has been around for a while, and now people are time shifting via online services like Hulu, other streaming services. Sometimes they're not watching a show until 5 years down the pike on Netflix. But the broadcast networks still command a hefty audience, especially when it comes to big events like a award shows, like live presentations, like sports, of course. So you can't quite write off the broadcast networks yet, but they are challenged, and they're just one piece of a quickly sort of sliced up pie.
And I would think we would be remiss if we didn't, you know, talk about what's going on in Hollywood these days, and a lot of criticism that's pointed at it over its lack of diversity. So here we go with an African American at the head of a network entertainment division.
Well, I think what's really interesting, and I actually have a story up today on our website, TVInsider.com. Nice plug, by the way, there, Mike Schneider. But you know, what's interesting about the Oscar So White controversy is you look at television, and TV is actually way ahead of the game versus film. About 4 or 5 years ago, you really started to see the fruits of real big efforts that a lot of different guilds have made, and even the networks have been making over time to bring more diversity both in front of the camera and also behind the camera. So television is doing a really great job. Shows like Empire and How to Get Away with Murder with African-American leads and other diverse leads on shows like Fresh Off the Boat on ABC and Jane the Virgin on CW, proving that it's good business in addition to creating some great content and attracting audiences that maybe weren't watching broadcast TV. So television has really been sort of going down a great path the past couple of years. Film could maybe take a look and maybe perhaps learn something from what television's been doing.
Will we see some of the, you know, fruits of her labor going forward? I mean, what will it be?
Well, you kind of already have. Channing was the head of drama development at ABC, and she's been there for a long time. She's been at Disney ABC since 2004. So a lot of those hits we've been talking about, she had a really big hand in developing, like Scandal, like How to Get Away with Murder, like Quantico, which is one of ABC's new shows this season, among others. So in some ways, the continuity is there. So even though Ben Sherwood's going to have a much more heavy hand than he did before in running ABC Entertainment, Channing's tastes, as well as the tastes of the other executives, are still in place.
All right. Michael Schneider, Chief Content Officer for TV Guide Magazine. Of course, he co-hosts KCRW's The Spinoff. We see him in the hallways sometimes here in the basement. Mike Schneider, thanks.
All right, Steve. Thank you, man.
In other entertainment business news, the Oscars are coming up at the end of this month. For nominees, that means interviews and photo shoots and red carpet stuff and swag. Or is it swag? Oscars gift bags are famously lavish, and the Academy says they've gotten so over the top that they're now suing the company that puts these big packages together. Basically, the Academy wants nothing to do with them. Kyle Buchanan is a senior editor for New York Magazine's entertainment website, Vulture. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. A lot of us probably assume that it's the Academy itself that puts together these gift bags, all this swag, as it were, but they actually have nothing to do with it. I didn't know that. Tell me about this.
Yeah, well, once upon a time, the Academy did. They would give out gift bags, and then the IRS got involved and ordered the Academy to pay taxes on those gift bags. And that's the point where the Academy decided to stop giving them out altogether. Now, into that breach came a whole lot of other companies that put together these lavish or not so lavish gift bags that they would offer to the stars, and the highest profile of those is Distinctive Assets that the Academy is now suing for sort of implying an affiliation with the official Academy and the official Oscars.
I suspect, Kyle, the swag bags are different between what the Academy used to give out before the whole tax thing and what Distinctive Assets is giving out. Tell me how they're different.
Well, they're definitely distinctive. They didn't lie about that. In addition to the sort of luxury vacations that you might expect in an A-list gift bag, you've also got a few other things like a breast lift, a vibrator, and a mind control seminar. Maybe not the things that the Academy would have chosen to give out. So the sort of juxtaposition of this sort of classy image that the Academy always strives to put forward and what Distinctive Assets is doing in these, gift bags where they're sort of straining for some sort of semi-official link is definitely the funny part here.
There's so much here, Kyle. So much.
So much.
I...
I mean,
we're
I skipped right over the vibrator.
No,
I just mentioned it once.
You're going to say it again on the air. Thank you so much, Kyle. We appreciate that. I really want to know about mind control. I mean, it seems like Hollywood's already under some sort of control. What are they asking? Let's get back to business and the lawsuit of this, because the Academy is taking Distinctive Assets to court. What are they asking for?
they're basically asking for them to stop implying that there's some sort of link. And the Academy is very stringent about this. They don't like, you know, they've got everything trademarked. They've got even just the name Oscar trademarked. If you try to start a website about the Oscars and you use Oscar in that website, they'll ask you to take that website down. They're very finicky when it comes to official usage of their images and their licenses and their name. And
what if it's Oscar the Grouch mind control? Like, straight out of a garbage can.
As long as Oscar the Grouch doesn't have any gold statuettes in that garbage can, he might be free and clear. But still, it could be a little iffy. So what they're doing here is they're trying to dissuade this company from implying any sort of affiliation. And the company hasn't been shy about that in the past. They've, you know, sent out these sort of carefully worded press releases that get a lot of coverage because people think this is an official gift bag. And I wouldn't doubt if some of the nominees thought that too, because so many of them, according to the company, have been taking these gift bags.
Have been taking them, right? Looking for that publicity. That's what they want here. What does the marketing company say in response as a rebuttal to the lawsuit that the Academy is bringing?
That the Academy is bringing?
Yeah.
They are, you know, they're sort of, I think they left themselves enough room in these press releases to argue that they haven't done anything that was untoward. You know, they never officially said that they were an Academy gift bag. But if you got that impression, they wouldn't mind it. They wouldn't talk you out of it.
It sounds like a lot of politics. It's so like presidential campaigning.
They're trying to sort of parse, the Academy is trying to parse the sort of generous language that Distinctive Assets was using.
When I think of this, Kyle, I think of gift bags, or this swag, as it were. Yeah. And in the middle of the Dolby Theater, all these people, all these actors, actresses, nominees, right? They have these bags under their seats. It's like an Oprah audience. Is that what's going on there? Does everyone get a car?
You know, it was a sort of a different situation when the Academy was actually giving those things out. I think you would get them if you were a nominee or if you were a presenter as you left. But since Distinctive Assets has no actual relationship with the Academy, they can't get within 10 feet of the Oscars. I think they are more reliant on having their publicist contact the star's publicist. But, you know, they're not the only people in this space. It's a crowded space, actually. They have a lot of swag suites pop up around the Oscars, particularly around the Golden Globes as well. Yeah, where celebrities can wander around, and as long as they're willing to take a picture with a product, they can take it home.
This seems to me like a gown that you wear, you know, on set. That sometimes that just happens to go home with an actress, right? Is that kind of the same thing here?
Yeah, except it's condoned. You know, these companies are hoping that they can lure actual A-listers to take their products. In a lot of cases, they'll settle for B and C-listers or just somebody with a lot of Instagram followers. You know, Distinctive Assets might have had a leg up because they were purportedly actually enticing real nominees to take their bags. But I think that with this Academy crackdown, you'll see a lot less of that.
Is it taxable, Kyle? I mean, is it like mind control, whatever it is, in those bags? I don't even want to mention the list that you gave me a little while ago. But
it's definitely supposed to be taxed, which is why the Academy stopped doing it themselves. You know, I think when the IRS got involved, they were demanding that the Academy pay back taxes on gift bags they'd given out over the last, you know, several decades. And the Academy did that, allegedly, although they wouldn't divulge that sum, and just decided it wasn't worth the hassle to keep on doing it. And that's why it sort of opened up this this avenue for other companies, more unscrupulous companies, to take advantage.
Exactly. I wonder if any stars have weighed in. Like, you know, are they poo-pooing the fact that maybe they're going to lose some of this swag?
Well, you know, that's sort of the tricky thing. I think you probably heard of the swag suites that Sundance used to have back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, all these people who would pose with snow boots or something more fancy than that. And I think that once the economy tanked, there was just a different mood about stars posing with things they were getting for free. It seemed like less of a classy thing to do, and it was sort of more of the bottom feeder stars who would do that. I think that with these purported Academy gift bags, part of the allure was that it was being done under the table, but now it's being done so under the table that I think people aren't going to bite.
And George Clooney, right, famously, like, gave this away to a charity. I don't want anything to do with this.
Yeah, that was back when the Academy was giving out those gift bags.
Oh, really? Okay.
Itself, right. Yeah. And he brought his to auction, and I think it fetched $45,000. There's a lot of great stuff in these bags, or at least there used to be. There might still be if you could wade past, the breast lifts.
Yeah. Okay. You're going to keep saying. How do you think, Kyle, this makes the Academy look? I mean, think about what we were talking about earlier about the lack of diversity in Hollywood and the big, brouhaha that stemmed from that. How does it make the Academy look with all this going on that they're devoting their attention to this?
Well, I have faith in their ability to multitask, but it is, I guess, maybe a funnier jam than the Academy has lately found itself in. Yeah, we've been dealing with
Funnier for you,
Oscar,
maybe not
so
for
why.
The Academy. I don't know.
Well, yes, no, absolutely. obviously the controversy about Oscar So White and the steps that the Academy is taking there are extremely important and are going to have long-reaching ramifications. But what they're also trying to do here is retain whatever semblance of class they've still got. They don't want other people to muddy up their waters. They're just trying to sort of revamp their image, and this isn't the sort of thing that helps them do that.
Kyle Buchanan, senior editor for New York Magazine's entertainment website, Vulture. Kyle, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Barbara Bogave is with us right now. She's in for Warren Olney with To The Point coming up in just, about 14 minutes. Hi, Barbara.
Hey, Steve, where's my press play shrag? My press play breast lift.
We'll put that together. I'm a Southern boy. We don't talk about things like that on the radio, so.
Well, moving on to The Point, though, we're also not going to talk about that. We're talking about Syria. And specifically, we're talking about humanitarian aid in Syria and how it's so complicated by the many warring factions, international, within the nation.
It's a humanitarian crisis, to be sure.
Yeah, and that really does, we're talking not only starvation, people under siege, but also war profiteering, not being able to even afford to compete, to pay for those humanitarian aid airdrops.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it coming up to The Point in just a few minutes. Barbara filling in for Warren Olney today. Thank you so much, Barbara.
Thank you.
Coming up on this show, Pope Francis is weighing in on contraception and Donald Trump's proposed wall between the United States and Mexico. That's next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California, and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Pope Francis just wrapped up a six-day trip to Cuba and Mexico. The Zika virus wasn't on his agenda, but on his flight back to the Vatican last night, he was asked whether church teaching on abortion and contraception could be loosened to help stop the spread of the virus to babies. Zika is thought to cause microcephaly, a birth defect that results in shrunken heads and brains in infants. It's been spreading through Latin America, which is heavily Catholic, and the church's teaching on abortion and contraception is very, very strict. Sarah Posner is a freelance journalist that writes about religion and politics, and she's with me right now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Public health advocates have been pushing for more access to abortion and contraception, certainly contraception for women in the affected areas of Zika. What did the Pope have to say about that when he spoke to reporters last night?
Well, the Pope was very clear that abortion is, in his words, a crime in all circumstances. So that is definitely off the table. And he left maybe a little bit open the possibility that contraception could be used in the fight against Zika, but in a very Francis type way, he was not, it was almost like he was floating it, but not really nailing it down. So it's unclear whether the church would make an exception for the Zika situation.
Like ending his statement, not with a period, but with a question mark.
Well, it's not really ending it with a question mark, but it's just saying it in this very Francis way that is, you know, very much a maybe, or this is something I'm thinking about, but not making a definitive statement about it.
Let's talk about definitive. What is the church's definitive position on contraception?
That the only method of contraception that is permissible is the rhythm method or abstinence. So any kind of, you know, condoms, birth control pills, diaphragms, you know, anything like that would not be acceptable according to church teaching, even though in the United States, you know, where obviously contraception is legal, something like, you know, 98, 99% of American Catholic women use it. It's just that it's not accessible like that in many of the countries where Zika is affecting women.
And to be sure, a leading Catholic bishop in Brazil recently said, quote, contraceptives are not a solution. Others have said similar things, but yet the Pope is as I mentioned, as you mentioned, doing things in a Francis way. Is there a disagreement within the church on how to handle this?
Well, that's possible. I'm, you know, not privy to conversations that are going on within the church about this, but I do know that in the past, when in similar situations where this has been brought up, one of the examples, one of the historic examples that was used was an exemption in the 1960s that was made for nuns that were living in the Congo who were at risk of sexual violence, and that Pope Paul VI had made an exemption for them. But I've seen conservative Catholics say, well, you know, that was for women religious. That was for the nuns. And this would be a very different situation for them.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the devout Catholics. Do Catholics in general actually follow the church on the issue of contraception?
Well, in the United States and, you know, probably in much of Europe as well, no. And, you know, the reality is in, you know, parts of Africa that are very affected by AIDS and HIV that, you know, under the table, you know, people get condoms, even in places where the Catholic Church is prominent. And even often I've heard from Catholic relief organizations. So, I mean, obviously the reality for human beings on the ground is very different than an abstract teaching. But the number of American Catholics who abide by the church teaching on contraception is extremely small, and the vast, vast majority of American Catholics use some sort of birth control.
American Catholics and European Catholics, as you mentioned, but Latin America is heavily Catholic, about 70%. It's down from more than 90% in the 1950s. Is the church sensitive to how these kinds of issues might, I don't know, affect its popularity on how it's being seen by the people who follow?
Well, Francis is extremely aware of the church's image around the world. And in Latin America, and, you know, he is from Latin America and is well aware of the growth of the evangelical and the Pentecostal churches there. So, you know, but I don't think that that's probably the predominant issue in his mind at this particular moment with this issue. I do think that he's probably seeing what's going on with the effect of Zika on babies. And, you know, it's hard to say how the church is going to end up in this. This is for inside the church. This would be extremely contentious if they were to say, yes, it's okay to use contraception. Will Catholic women in Latin America use it anyway? Yes. But at the same time, you know, the abortion thing is completely off the table. And in many Latin American countries where Zika is spreading, abortion is absolutely illegal and inaccessible.
I want to switch gears, Sarah, before we are finished this afternoon. And the Pope, I think, nudged his pontiff's hat into the presidential race at least a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I've got to ask you about this, because he also suggested that Donald Trump, quote, is not Christian. He didn't mention Trump by name, but he alluded to Trump and his harsh language on immigrants and the border, saying a true Christian would not build a wall between the two countries. Are you surprised that he weighed in on a politician's faith?
Well, again, let's remember that he was on the plane, he had a press conference, and he was asked about it. So according to the press reports of this exchange with reporters, the Pope said building walls instead of bridges is not Christian. This is not in the gospel. And that the Pope said that he hadn't heard about Trump's plan, which I find a little implausible. I'm sure he has heard about Trump's plan. But that he took reporters' word for it. This is according to the reporting at Crux, which is the Boston Globe's authoritative Vatican coverage.
And for his part, Donald Trump called those words disgraceful, I believe,
yes.
in the campaign
yes.
today as a rebuttal
yes.
to the Pope. So now there's a back and forth between the Pope and Donald Trump.
Well, this is not new for Trump. He raised very similar issues about the Pope back in August and September when the Pope was planning his visit to the United States, and the Pope had considered doing this Mexico visit at that time. He subsequently changed his mind and made it two separate visits. But Trump leveled these same accusations at the Pope back in August and September. And you have to look at what's happening in the presidential campaign when Trump accuses the Pope of being wrong about these immigration issues. It always comes at a time when it's a crucial moment for Trump. Back in August, it was when he was struggling to find his footing with religious voters and making religious gaffes, like not being able to cite a Bible verse that he likes. And this time, it was right in advance of the South Carolina primary, where he's trying to court religious voters.
Religious voters who, by the way, aren't necessarily Catholic. They're evangelicals.
They're probably not Catholic, which plays another sort of like ugly card that it shows another ugly card that Trump is playing here. But the thing to remember is that the Pope is probably the only other person on the planet who can garner as much media attention for a single comment that Trump can. And so when you see the Pope having these high-profile visits and getting all this media attention and be able to get all this attention for saying one thing, Trump is going after him when the Pope is eating into Trump's own media attention.
Sarah
so I think
Posner.
That's important thing to remember.
Sarah Posner, journalist and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Jolie Myers is here for a quick wrap-up and some feedback. What's up?
Yeah. You know, there were some really important things spoken about on our show today.
Yes.
But our listeners have really seized on the debate over swag versus swag.
Oh, no.
I know our director, Matt Holzman, went on dictionary.com and insisted that it was
gosh.
Swag,
we
which
had this
it apparently
in the newsroom earlier.
Is. It has been ongoing all day today, but most of our Twitter followers are saying swag.
Not
S-W-A-G,
swag.
No swag about it. We have Justin Sedgwick saying, isn't swag just a version of like crappy marijuana?
This is true. there's not an untruth there.
But R.C. Langley says it sounds to me like a north-south thing, so it could be that.
Maybe.
Where do you fall?
I'm on swag. I said swag. I was
swag,
with Matt
I'm
Holzman
swag.
On this. Yeah.
I'm swag all the way,
you're
so there's
swag,
our north-south.
There you go. I guess so. Jolie Myers, thanks.
Of course.
We appreciate it. That does it for us today. I'm Steve Chiotakis in for Madeline Brand. I'll be back tomorrow. To the Point is next with Barbara Bogave. Have a great day.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.